And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Philippe Matthews Show. U.S. District Court Judge Robert L. Wilkins is with us today, tackling the complicated and long history and the creation of the National Museum of African American History and Culture and his absorbing account of the book entitled Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African American History and Culture. My goodness, welcome, my friend. How are you?
Thank you, Philippe. I'm doing great. How are you?
I am wonderfully great because I'm wonderfully honored because of the work that you and so many others have done to not only preserve this history, but collect this history and then bring forth, in my opinion, perhaps one of the most remarkable museums in modern day history.
Yeah, it's really amazing that we've come to this point. And, you know, this museum is 100 years in the making, as I discuss in my book, Long Road to Hard Truth, and going back to Mary McLeod Bethune and James Baldwin and Hank Aaron and so many other people along the way have wanted to see this museum happen and to have it finally happen and, you know, happen during the tenure of President Obama is really, you know, Hollywood couldn't have written a better story.
Perfect script, right? Perfect script. I'm looking at the cover of the book, and the at the top of the book is this, you know, beaten down, weather-beaten little shack that's kind of standing on its last leg, and that was the original museum.
That was actually a slave cabin on a plantation in South Carolina, in Edisto Island, South Carolina. And that was taken apart board by board and transported to Washington, D.C. and reassembled. And it's in the museum, which is in the bottom half of the front cover. So it was really, to me, a way to symbolize the journey of from where we've come from to where we are today.
Unbelievable. How long did it take to build this? I mean, it's just an amazing piece of architecture.
Yeah, it's an iconic structure. It really is. And, it's a great achievement because it was designed by, you know, architects of African descent, the first museum on the mall, so designed, and they just did a fabulous job. I mean, the groundbreaking was in February of 2012, and for it to open now, you know, just this past month, you know, it took about 4.5 years to build it, which for a project of this size and scope and complexity was really phenomenal.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, I was watching on CNN, I was watching that Frederica was doing tour of the layers and the different floors and the different layouts, and I mean, it's overwhelming. I can't wait to. I mean, it's one of those things. It's like our Mecca. You can't be an African American in this country and not go and be a part of see your history.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just think about all of the thousands and thousands and thousands of young people, school children who will attend this museum and get a better perspective on the country, upon, you know, African-American history and culture and the contributions and achievements of African-Americans and, you know, just really a better understanding of who we are as a nation and, you know, what we can achieve working together as a nation. I just think, you know, it really should be, you know, a required stop for as many kids as possible that can make it here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now this book is also chronicling the history, of and honoring, our history of our Black soldiers. Talk to us about that, because that's very, very important.
So, yes, I mean, I knew nothing about this until I really started digging into, you know, why there was no, you know, National African American History Museum. And I learned that, you know, this began in 1916, and it was begun really as an effort to honor black soldiers and sailors who had fought in every war for the United States, you know, beginning in the Revolutionary War. But particularly it was motivated to honor black Civil War veterans who had fought for the Union. And the Union had a two-day victory parade where 200,000 soldiers marched from the Capitol past the White House at the end of the Civil War in 1865. And not a single colored regiment was invited to participate in that parade.
Mm.
And that was such a slight, such an insult, such a dishonor to those veterans. And that the 50th anniversary of the end of the Civil War in 1915, they had a reenactment of that parade, and black veterans were invited and allowed to come participate, which was good. But it was in the age of Jim Crow, and there was segregation. There was no hotels for them to stay. There were no balls or entertainment for them. And the black community was told, if you want anything for these black veterans, you have to do it yourself.
Uh-huh.
And so they formed a colored citizens committee chaired by a gentleman named Ferdinand DeSoto Lee, who went to Hampton University and then the Howard Law School. And they organized so that these black veterans coming from all over the country would be, you know, entertained and have a place to stay, et cetera, while they were in Washington. And that committee decided that that wasn't enough, that they wanted a permanent memorial in the nation's capital honoring black soldiers and sailors. And over the course of the next couple of years, they realized that, you know, blacks had done a lot more than just participated in the military. They had contributed in all areas of life, and it should really be a museum, what they called a memorial building to Negro achievement. And that's how this all began 100 years ago.
You also talk about the slander of the film Birth of a Nation in the back of it. Talk to me about that.
So Birth of a Nation came out in February of 1915,
mm-hmm.
and was shown in the White House that same month to President Woodrow Wilson, who had gone to college with the author of the book, The Klansman, that The Birth of a Nation is based upon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the movie was a slander to the African-American community in general, and especially to black Civil War veterans, because it just portrayed them in such an awful light,
mm-hmm.
and portrayed the black people in general in such an awful light, and basically portrayed the Klan as this heroic group that came to prevent white people from being traumatized and terrorized by blacks. And that movie was taking the country by storm. You know, around this same time that the 50th anniversary of the Civil War victory was happening in Washington. And so this group that organized to create this memorial, they, you know, a lot of these people were organizing and protesting against the film. And indeed, their very first rally that they held in Washington, D.C., they had emblazoned across the top of the flyer, Birth of a Race, because they saw this memorial to Negro achievement as a counter to Birth of a Nation.
Mm.
And so it's interesting that this museum is opening now, and the remake of Birth of a Nation, but from the perspective of Nat Turner, his hitting the screens. So the ironies and the interesting historical coincidences keep occurring here.
It is something to sit back and you know, you can kind of say, is this coincidence or is this something a little bit higher that's going on? Is there, you know, there seems to be especially with a young people, there seems to be a new level of consciousness and movement because they weren't around when I don't know how old you are, but was around enough. They don't remember, like, you know, the March of King. They don't have that history of the 60s and 70s as we do. Yet they have such a sense of their culture and what it means to be African American in this country. What is your thoughts on the bridge of these of this generation versus our generation and before that with this work?
Well, I think we're in an important time, and I have teenage sons, and you know, in a lot of ways, they are so much more sophisticated and knowledgeable than I was at their age. I think the educational system is a lot more advanced as far as, you know, the type of study of history and social studies and political science that they're getting even at the middle school and high school level. Plus, you know, with the internet, they are, you know, exposed to so much more information. Of course, a lot of that is bad information and slanted propaganda, you know, untrue information, but there's a lot of, you know, very good information out there as well. So, you know, people are much more aware in a lot of ways of the context and interconnection of things, and I think that this museum can help put things even in better context for people. Because they can see the long breadth of the journey and, you know, how we've made progress and then how in some ways a lot of things that people are protesting about today are very similar to things that people were protesting about in the 1960s as well.
Do you, and of course that sparks the question, do you think we have moved forward, or do you think it's just same bat place, same bat channel, as they say?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the country has moved forward in a lot of ways. You know, over the past, certainly over the past 100 years, and even over the past 50 years. You know, I don't believe that that means that, you know, everything is perfect and people shouldn't continue to try to continue to make this a more perfect union. But I think that it's a mistake to just you know, always look at everything as the glass is half empty all the time as well.
What about those who say that, well, we got a black president now, and so racism is pretty much done?
Well, you know,
I
I've
know
never
that was going to chuckle
subscribed
out of
to
you.
that. I never subscribed to that myself. I mean, but it, I think it is a great achievement. I think that, you know, people like my grandparents and others, you know, my maternal grandmother lived to see, you know, President Obama elected, and I know how much that meant to her. And I think that a lot of people, you know, never thought that this would happen in their lifetimes, or that they would see that happen. And indeed a tremendous achievement. And I think it does mark, in so many ways, you know, progress as a nation. But, you know, you can, you know, easily find incidents that happen or statements that are made or events that occur that, you know, would call into question whether all racial discrimination has ended, and I would say that it has not. But, you know, I don't think that, you know, the perfect has to be the enemy of the good here. And where just because you know, everything isn't perfect, we say, you know, the election of President Obama means nothing.
How long did it take you to write this book? How did, what was the beginning process for you to begin to sit down at your computer? I don't know if you wrote by hand, or I don't know what your writing process is. What was that day like when you said, okay, I'm sitting down, I'm going to write this down?
Well, you know, about 15 or so years ago, I wrote a manuscript that was, you know, kind of a summary of the guts of the book, so to speak.
Okay.
But about a year and a half ago, I realized that I wanted the story of this museum to be told, and I wanted it to be told, you know, by the time that, you know, at the same time that this museum opened, so that people would hopefully understand this museum a little better and appreciate it more.
Mm-hmm.
And so about a year and a half ago, I just realized that, you know, the clock was ticking and I needed to sit down and get busy writing this book. And there were a lot of late nights and early mornings and even all-nighters to get it done, but I managed to pull it off.
What were the hardest parts? What was the most difficult aspects of pulling together the data for this book and doing the research?
Well, you know, fortunately, I had done a lot of the research over the years in the work that I had done in you know, working with others to push Congress to create this museum and serving on the presidential commission that Congress created back in 2001 to write a plan of action for, you know, to how this museum could be created. So a lot of the research had been done. And fortunately, you know, since then, so much more is available and is digitized. And, you know, there are old newspapers and congressional records and other databases that exist today that weren't even around, you know, in the early 2000s. So that really helped out a lot with the research. But what was really probably the most difficult part for me was to try to figure out how to pack all of this information into something that was readable and accessible from everyone from, you know, your high school age, you know, young person to you know, an older professional person. So I hope that I did that with the book to make it, you know, to make it informative, but not beyond the reach of the average layperson. That was, you know, a challenge.
Absolutely. So what did you learn about, you know, I always ask this question, what did you learn about yourself, about your blackness, about your African American lineage and heritage, about your people? What did you learn about this?
Well, I think one of the things that I learned was just how remarkable and how resilient, you know, black people have been over the years. Because, you know, if you think about in March of 1916, when Ferdinand Lee and the others incorporated a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. to build a memorial to black soldiers and sailors, they did that in the face of this movie, Birth of a Nation, going across the country and taking the country by storm.
Mm.
They did that at the same time that there were members of Congress, a congressman from Arkansas that was introducing legislation to ban blacks from the military on the theory that, you know, black people shouldn't be armed. They were brutes and they were terrorists and they shouldn't, you know, be in the military. And having blacks in the military was driving good white men out because they didn't want to serve alongside blacks. So you had people who, like, in the face of all of that said, you know, we're going to stand up to honor our heritage and to demand, you know, recognition for our contributions and achievements. And in the face of all of that, do so, you know, using the mechanisms in the political process and playing by the rules, even though there were so many, you know, people who, you know, literally spit in their face and told them that, you know, black people didn't deserve anything because they hadn't contributed anything. I mean, they were told that in, you know, on the floor of Congress, but they persevered.
Wow. Bringing that forward to today, looking at yourself as a role model, becoming becoming a U.S. District Court judge. What advice?
Actually, I'm on the Court of Appeals now. So
Court of Appeals. Oh my gosh.
Yes. But I started out on the district court. Now I'm on the Court of Appeals. So, at any rate.
Okay. I stand corrected. that being said, even more so now, actually the question is even better suited. Given the history of what we have gone through and what we have grown through, what words of wisdom would you give our young people today who might not be doing it at the level that, you know, we had to do it or our ancestors had to do it, but they're doing something? What advice or direction would you give them today?
Well, I would say to them, you know, keep the faith, don't be discouraged, and try to, you know, figure out how to be effective at whatever you're doing. That's really kind of the motto that I live my life by, is how can I be most effective? And to think about that, and to think about how you can build bridges and build coalitions and work with others where you can, and where you can't, you know, fine, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
But to figure out how to be effective with what you're doing. And I think that a lot of people spend time, you know, angry or upset or protesting in circumstances where it doesn't really lead to anything. And that can be discouraging. And
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, to the young people, I would say, you know, don't be discouraged, but look at how, you know, you can be more effective the next time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time out and being with me. Thank you for the honor of producing this work that I get a chance in my lifetime to read this book, to be a part of this history. You know, it is ironic a little bit that George Bush wrote this in and started the process for this to begin. But in terms of fundraising, I think was it Oprah Winfrey that put in at least $52 million to this museum? That's absolutely.
Yeah, she was the largest donor with I think $21 million. You know, there's a gentleman named Robert Smith gave another $20 million. I think Shonda Rhimes gave $10 million. There were a lot of large donors and a lot of small donors. And you know, the black community in general, from, you know, the entertainers and sports figures and business figures on down to just, you know, common everyday people, really got behind the Smithsonian and this museum. And I think that was a very powerful thing.
That's absolutely amazing, amazing. You're an amazing human being. I honor you, and I thank you for being with me today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
We'll talk to you soon. We'll see you guys next time on the Philippe Matthews Show Live. Take care, everybody.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.